and how it became the religion, certainly of today. And I think it's so much in the pages of history. I was telling you about a book I have, and this is it. And if I lost that, I think I'd cry. It's 1840. I guess that baby lost the book. Not really. That's how you feel when you lose something in a book like this. 1840. And it starts with the history of the Roman Empire. It starts in 29 B.C. You know, it says that you can't see it probably, but it's 29. And every page. You can't see that? Jim, can you see that? You can see it. But anyhow, it goes all the way up to 476 B.C. I mean A.D. from 29 B.C. And it's historically all the way through. And it's got all the religions, where they changed, how Christianity changed, how the Passover was done away with, and all. It's really amazing. It's in this book. And I'm going to try to, I probably won't read much of that tonight, but I was reading a little bit of it today, and I have gone through it. And it's a tremendously good history book. But like I said, this probably was a library book at one time, and in the back it's got the date due and everything, and they just sold it out. I don't know what I paid for this. I can't remember, but 75 cents. 75 cents for a book like that. So that's a fantastically good book. I'm not going to show it to Mr. Blackwell. I told you what happened when I showed him my last book. No, I'd show it to him. I'm just kidding. What I'm going to go through tonight, I want to show you how the Samaritan religion became the counterfeit Christianity. And I looked up the word Gnosticism. I don't know if any of you happened to look it up, but I have a pretty thorough dictionary, and I was really amazed. I was kind of happy that as I was going through it, what I found on it. But I'll just read basically what the dictionary that I have. I'll give you the name of the dictionary. I even Xeroxed it because I was so taken back exactly how well it covered Gnosticism. And I'll just read it for you here. Gnosticism, an eclectic system of philosophy and religion, which flourished during the first 6 centuries of the present, you know, era. In other words, the first 6 centuries as we would know them right now from the time of Christ. It sought to mediate between Christianity and paganism and taught that knowledge more than philosophy or faith was the means of salvation. According to their doctrine, all existence, both spiritual and material, originated in the deity by successive emanations. You see how philosophy comes in. You can understand that. Somebody explain it to me. These they termed eons, and Christ was conceived to be a higher eon only. The system combined the main features. Now listen to this. Gnosticism, which Simon Magus is said to be the father of, this system combined the main features of Orientalism, Platoism, dualism, and Christianity. Combined them all. Now, can you imagine why it was called a universal church? See, the universal church is because it combined the Oriental type of religion with Plato type of thinking, dualism, and Christianity. So it just combined the whole world and combined it all into a term called Christianity. Now, the word for Gnostic means to know. It means shrewd, knowing, wise. So if you were a Gnostic, then obviously you would be shrewd and wise. So it means we know. See, what do they know? Well, they just combined all of the world's religions into one. Now, as I mentioned last week, I don't know how much I need to read of that, but I'll read it again. They called it the Magian philosophy. Simon's doctrine. Who is Acts 8, Simon Magus? Simon's doctrines were substantially those of the Gnostics, see? And he is not without reason regarded as the first. Notice this, the first. No wonder he's called the Father, because he is called the Father in here. I want you to get that part of it. He is now without reason regarded as the first who attempted to engraft the theurgy and egotism of the Magian philosophy upon Christianity. See? He's the first to combine all those, so that's why he's called the Father. As I mentioned back there in Acts 8, he was the first pope. That was 33 A.D. when he was baptized. And so that's where he goes back and states that he was the first. Now, over here in the Jewish world, in the time of Christ, as I mentioned on page, these are all older books, so you probably wouldn't be able to find them, on page 250, in this depressing confusion, one name arrests our attention, that of Simon the Samaritan, the famous Simon Magus, who passes across the stage of primitive Christianity and occupies a place in the Petrine legend, in making of him the father of all the heresies. The father of all the heresies. Now you can find that debated, and even in this book right here, this man talks about it and says, well, we have no evidence to prove that. But I'll show you that we have some evidence to prove that. I did go back through some of our old literature, and it's pretty well documented that Simon Magus was the beginning of what we would call today the Roman Catholic Church, the universal church. He's the first one that made a universal religion. He tied all of the different thoughts together. Now, so then we can find out what this Gnostic idea is. So when you talk about Gnosticism, you're talking about the first person who combined all of the religions of this world into one form and called it, quote-unquote, Christianity. That's why Acts 8 is so important, because Simon was baptized, and he was giving out that he was some great one. And as I read last week, I read to you that great one means that he was a Messiah. He was going around saying he was greater than Christ. See, that's why remember back in John where it says, try the spirits to see which one, you know, whether it's God, because there's a spirit of Antichrist, and it talks about he that says Christ has come in the flesh. They began to say that Christ was just an individual. He was not as great. Simon Magus was the greatest, see, and so on. So Simon Magus tied all together, became the founder of the universal religion, the first pope, because he was its father, see. Christ is the father, Satan is called the father of the lies because he's the originator of it. So Simon Magus is called the father, basically, because he was its founder. Now, so he was the first quote-unquote holy father. He was the originator of this form of religion as we know it today, 33 A.D. Now, I'm going to read this in its verbatim about the Roman world in the time of Christ. And I think you're going to begin to see now how Simon Magus found a ready world for him, or, you know, a society for him to go into. Now, this is this believing world, and it's on page 100 of this believing world. I don't have the author of it. You can get it if somebody wanted to, but this, is an older book, but a very good book, and I'll just read it. I'm going to read most of it because it's going to open your eyes to what Rome believed before Christianity. And you're going to be shocked at what was going on in Rome before it ever became quote-unquote Christian. I'm going to read it all because I was looking through it for excerpts, but the more I read it, I thought, no, you need to hear it all. So the religious history of Rome was in many respects strikingly like that of Greece. It began, of course, in the universal primitive belief, notice this, the universal primitive belief that all objects are animated by resident or roving spirits. But the chief of these spirits were of a peculiar type in Rome, being not tribal, but they were family deities. Now notice this, did you ever hear of the Casanova, you know, the mafia? That's a family. Notice this, the chief of these spirits were of a peculiar type in Rome, not being tribal, they were family-type deities. That was because the early Romans were a farming folk, divided not into large units like tribes, but into small families. Naturally enough, the primal aim of the religion was the perpetuation of these small families, and the principal spirits therefore, were those which guarded the home. Each man was believed to have what was called a genius, a spirit personifying his virility. And each woman had what was called a Juno. See, the month of June is in her honor, a spirit personifying her power to conceive. The early Romans, like most other primitive peoples, were driven by their constant struggle against extinction to consider the power of reproduction a miraculous and highly divine thing. The threshold of every house had its guardian spirit called Janus, which is January. As I mentioned, that's the god that could look both ways, and very likely was either Shem, or Noah. And that was Janus because they looked both ways. They looked over on the other side of the flood and this way. And that's why they started the month with January, because he could look back to the old year and he could also look on to the new year. You see, that's why January is the first month. The threshold of every house had its guardian spirit called Janus, just as the hearth had its Vesta. I'm going to read a little bit about Vesta in a dictionary, and you'll begin to understand where some of the thoughts of Roman Catholicism come in. The storeroom had its Penates, and the farm had its Larus. The favor of these spirits was courted with simple ceremonies on fixed holy days. See, the favor of these spirits was courted with simple ceremonies on fixed holy days, each family having its own altar on its own land, its own priest in the person of a pater family. See, it had its own priest in the form of a pater. See, it's where padre comes from, because it even mentions it. Just a form of that. Pater. So I said, that's pater, Simon Pater, you see. Person of the pater families. I'm going to go into that next week. I may not have a chance. But where the term pater, Peter, comes from. And I'll tell you, you'd be shocked at how much it's in our thinking today and how much we talk that way in forms, different forms today. Like interpret. Interpret means it's a Peter translation is what it is. If you interpret, see, back in the Old Testament, they've got those words. That means an interpeter. See, he could go into the intermystery and interpret, because he was that type of pater. And that's back in, you can find that term back in, I think it's Genesis 41, verse 8. And I have an article on that says that goes right back, and that's what that means. Pater, interpret, enter, you can go into it because you're a pater. See, that's where interpretation came from, the term. You understand some of the things that we just take for granted today. Now notice this. He was the father of the family, the spirit, or the priest, I'm sorry. See, the priest was the father of the family. Does that think that's something today? Now, this was before Christianity. Some of the spirits were also worshipped with minor rites observed in everyday life. For instance, after every midday meal, a sort of grace was offered to Vesta. That's a woman, by the way. I'll show you that. By throwing a salt cake into the hearth. Now, I want to show you something here about Vesta. You can look it up. This is the dictionary. This is Webster's Universal Unabridged Dictionary. I have a two-volume set, so it's probably a lot more thorough than some of you have. Let's read about Vesta here. In Roman mythology, the virgin goddess of the hearth. See? That's who Vesta was. Now, they had this before Christ now. This goes back to 600, almost 600 B.C. And it's fire. She was a protectress of the home and of the state. The sacred fire brought by Aeneas from Troy was preserved in her temple in the Forum. Six Vestals, now notice it, six Vestals watched by day and by night to prevent its dying out. That was this eternal fire. Now when John Kennedy was put to rest, he has eternal fire over his grave. Now notice this, these Vestals watched by day and by night to preserve, it could never go out. In astronomy, I'll go down with it further now. Okay, now let's deal with Vestal Virgin. They had Vestal Virgins. Now listen to this. A virgin that was consecrated to Vesta and to the service of watching the sacred fire, which was to be perpetually kept burning upon the altar. The Vestals were six in number. They entered the service of the goddess at from 6 to 10 years of age. Their term of service lasted 30 years. Then they were permitted to marry. See, after they were out of it. But few did so, as they were treated with great honor and had important public privileges. Their persons were inviolable, and the Vestal found guilty of unchastity was together with her paramour put to death. Now, the other definition of it is that a Vestal means a virgin, a woman of spotless chastity, a nun. See that? That's in your Webster's Unabridged Dictionary. So you see, there were nuns. Now, I was over in Greece at the Acropolis, and I've seen some of these high, you know, buildings with the Vestal virgins around it. And so there were nuns back at that time. This goes back to 600 B.C. So I'm just going to show you what was already in Rome, quote-unquote, before Christianity ever got there. Okay, so she was offered a sort of grace. So they prayed to Vesta, who was the goddess. And she had Vestal virgins. Okay, but this simple family cult had to give way in time to a less primitive form of religion. Harried by continual attacks from the enemy tribes, the little family groups were forced to consolidate into the state of Rome, city-state of Rome. And then a state religion arose. They had a family religion, which was a father, a priest that was called a father over the small little family. Then they went to a state religion. So now we've got a whole bunch of little families with fathers over them. And now we have a state religion, and you're going to notice how their thinking made that into a leading father. It centered chiefly around a god of war who was called Mars. Now Mars is what was, March is named after. See, that's your Roman calendar. It was just like the Romans to make a god of war their chief deity. And they included the worship also of other gods, especially a sky god called Jupiter. Now this was the Roman version of the Greek Zeus Pater, and that's what it means, Jupator. See, Jupiter, which means Zeus, which is the highest god, Pator. You see, high, that's what it is. Jew, this is a shortened version of Zeus, Pator. Okay, the king of the city-state was the high priest of this newer, now, Roman religion. See, the king then became the high priest. See, you're going to see the Pontifex Maximus, as he'll be called in just a little bit. The Roman version of the Greek Zeus Pater. The king of the city-state was the high priest of this newer Roman religion, and numerous minor priests aided him at the state altar. Can you begin to see the Roman system? So then these little priests of over the family then began to be with the king, and they would work with the king. So it became kind of a family sort of a group with the priest that was over the family working with the king who was the top. Okay? Now, and numerous minor priests aided him at the state altar. But there was no great fervor in the cult, for it was far more a political than a religious institution. It was a formal civic affair, and though many festivals were listed in its elaborate calendar, no demands were made on the people to take a passionate part in them. Most of these festivals must have antedated the state religion, see, for they were marked by magic rites of evident primitiveness. There was, for instance, the Lupercalia, a festival at which the worshippers smeared themselves with sacrificial blood from a dog or a goat, sponged themselves with milk-soaked wads of wool, clad themselves in goat skins, and then danced through the street of the city, striking the women they met with bits of skin to make them fertile. Maybe we ought to try that today. You don't need that, though. Now, notice this one. Then there was the Saturnalia, celebrated on the 25th of December, and the signal for more wild dancing, and especially for giving gifts and lighting many candles. 600 B.C. You get that? The Saturnalia. That means the sun, Saturn, or, you know, that means it talks about the sun, celebrated on the 25th of December, the signal for more wild dancing, especially for giving gifts and lighting many candles. But the old family religion still persisted despite the institution of the state cult. See, the old family religion. See, Rome was family. The mafia would tell you that. It's a family. See, the godfather. See, the head father of that family. That goes right back to how the Roman mind thinks. See, so there's not much difference if you get the picture. The worship of the hearth spirit still went on, and still a great concern was felt about evil ghosts and demons. For protection, firebrands used to be tied to the tails of foxes who were then let loose in the fields to frighten away the crop-devouring demons. For further protection, men and cattle were passed through fire. See? Passed through fire. You notice that same thing the Israelites were guilty of, passing through the fire, so they might be magically purified. Taboos of a thousand varieties to ward off as many sorts of dangers were scrupulously observed in every house in the growing town. The religion of the city-state of Rome was only supposed to be the new state cult. Actually, the people still clung to their family cult of early days. A distinct change did occur, however, about the 6th century B.C. A big change began to happen. So this was even before 600 B.C. Now, why did a distinct change occur about the 6th century B.C.? I gave a sermon on that not too long ago, maybe about 6 or 8 months ago, talking about how when Nebuchadnezzar took over the world, every religion changed on the face of the earth. He was the head of gold, you see, Nebuchadnezzar. And he, you can find Oriental religion starting in 600 B.C. Very seldom when you go back in history can you go back and find the beginning of anything before 600 B.C., except, you know, Egypt and some of the other things. But I'm talking about the theater or the arts or anything. It always goes back to Greece about 600 B.C., goes back to Babylon, which was the head of gold. Even our monetary system, based upon gold, goes back to Nebuchadnezzar. So 600 B.C., there was a distinct change. It came as an after effect of the invasion of the Etruscans, a race which apparently had higher capacities for civilization than the original Romans. They took over the state religion and made it a thing of far greater importance than ever it ever had been before. New gods were introduced, Minerva, Diana, and others. A college of priests was founded, and the priesthood was organized under a chief who was called Pontifex Maximus. See, this was 600 B.C., see, long before Christ. A priesthood was organized, you notice, and he was under the chief who was called the Pontifex Maximus. For the first time in the history of Rome, temples were built, and images of the gods were placed in them and worshipped. But even after the state religion remained in large part, it even remained then a large formal affair. It had too little emotional drive to slight a relation to hope and to fear and hope, even to be able to enter deep into the life of the people. The priests were more or less civic officials who were left to attend the gods, much as in constitutional monarchies, the chamberlains are left to attend to the king. The gods demanded that the vows of the people made to them should be most scrupulously observed, but they insisted on very little else. They were not immoral or venal, like the gods of the Olympian religion, but neither were they puritanically, moral or tyrannically strict, like, for instance, the god of the Hebrews. See, they didn't go clear to the immoral, but they weren't as strict as the Jews. See, they sort of in between being immoral and totally puritanical. I think that pretty well describes religion today. They seem to be quite content with just purely formal obeisance. You begin to understand, you know, there's nothing more formal than kind of their formality, their ceremonies in the Roman Catholicism. Of course, such a religion, clean, but not very exciting, proper, but not very compelling, could not persist for long. So between 500 and 200 B.C., we were still way before the time of Christ, it deteriorated and sank into almost complete bankruptcy. The whole structure rotted away from corruption and finally toppled to the ground. And with it toppled the family religion. See, the family religion. Rome by that time had become a vast empire, rich, mighty, and not a little dissolute. Roman citizens had gone forth as soldiers or traders to the farthest ends of the known world and had come back spoiled. The old Roman family, which had been so important a factor of social health in the early life of the people, fell into decay. And with it, the old family gods went into the limbo. The priests became grafting politicians, and their training colleges more political clubs. And then the old order ended. But as fast as the old gods fell away, new gods arose. For the most part, they were savior gods of the Orient. Those lusty relics of the savage past, which were immortal in more than myth. The Roman legions had gone out to conquer all the world, only to come back conquered by all of its gods. The mysteries that had spread like a plague throughout Greece in the days of its decay now found similar soil in which to flourish in Rome as early as 200 B.C., the cult of Cybele, the great mother of the gods, was brought into the city, imported from Asia Minor, see? So Rome brought all these gods back. So you're beginning to see now that this Gnosticism found a good hold in Rome, because the mother of the gods now became in there about 200 B.C. Imported from Asia Minor, where it may have developed out of the old Babylonian worship of Ishtar. It was. It wasn't just maybe. This mystery found its chief sanctuary on Vatican Hill. See? The great mother of the gods then now found her home on Vatican Hill, almost on the precise spot where St. Peter's now stands. St. Peter's now stands where this great, worshiping of the mother of the gods was. Now, there and wherever else in the empire the cult had a following, spirit spring festivals of almost incredible bestiality were held. The people gathered around altars erected under sacred trees. Amid the thundering of drums, the screeching of flutes, and the clashing of cymbals, they wildly sought salvation of their goddess. First, the lower priests, excited by the barbaric music, would begin to whirl themselves around convulsively. With mad eyes and streaming hair, they would whirl themselves until wrapped in a frenzy and insensible to pain, they would begin to hack at their own flesh, hack and slash at their own bodies until both altar and tree were red with the spurting blood. Remember that at the time of Elijah. That's what they were doing. That's an old idea. Even the Indians of old did that here. See, going around in wild frenzies until they just literally were wiped out as far as their thinking power would go. And then the spectator, caught up and swept out of their minds by the tumult, would suddenly join in the dance. A mad light would leap into their eyes. Demon would take them over. At the sight of the blood and the sound of the throbbing music, jaws would open up wide and their waggling heads and limbs would swing out and flail like to the beat of drums and cymbals. And then first one, then another, would suddenly tear off all of his clothes and with a manic shout would seize a sword from the heap ready at hand. Howling with ecstasy, he would hack at himself until exhausted at last, he fell and lay bleeding in a ditch. I want to read all this so you can kind of get an idea of what they've glossed over today. This is the beginning of what you're talking about, modern Christianity today. Of course, such self-mutilation was not the ordinary act of devotion in the call of Sabelli. Only those of the extremist faith those who desired to become actual priests of the goddess ever went to such excesses. So you see, there's a goddess, Queen of Heaven, and these things were being done. But even the common followers, the ordinary first degree initiates, went through rites which were far more adequately gruesome. Now, you begin to think of Jezebel. She was the woman back at the time when Elijah told those people to start shouting because God can't hear. And you can see this is no wonder God says about calling this great whore a Jezebel. You can see because it goes back to those kind of rites. There was, for example, the rite called the Terebolium. The candidate was placed in a pit and then washed in the blood of a bull slaughtered over his head. He had to lathe himself in the warm blood as it came dripping through the crevices between the planks covering the pit. He had to crane up avidly and receive it upon his face, in his ears, his eyes, upon his mouth, and thus he was initiated into the mystery. Now notice this though. Madness? No, merely logic gone wild. Because based upon wild hypotheses, the first axiom of primitive magic. Now notice this, in the Indians did this. I used to read this about Pontiac, and some of the others did the same thing. They held that any quality could be acquired merely by consuming the proper part of a creature already possessing that quality. For instance, a man could take on his enemy's strength merely by eating his enemy's liver. Now that's how Pontiac would tear out the heart of a man, Chief Pontiac, that they named Pontiac, Michigan, after. He would tear out the heart of a man and eat it raw because he thought he could consume the strength of a tremendously strong fighting man. He could acquire his father's cunning simply by consuming his father's eye. So to acquire his god's immortality, it seemed only necessary to quaff that god's blood. See, that's why they were drinking that blood. That's why in the time of Acts 15, he said, keep them from what? Sacrificing and the eating of blood. Because they thought they could take the strength of another man from the eating of that blood. I mean, the strength of a god from eating that blood. A feat not all impossible, because the god was usually imagined to be incarnate in some sacred human being or animal. Such was the logic, false but plausible, which led to blood guzzlings like those in the call of Sabelle. Such was the reasoning, cracked but intensely human, which led men in Rome to seek salvation through the Terebolium. Closely associated with this orgiastic worship of Sabelle, there was also the worship of her lover Attis. This god Attis was believed to have been conceived. Now notice this. I want you just to hear this. This god Attis was believed to have been conceived immaculately in the womb of a virgin. Now this was before Christ. Don't think Satan didn't know what was going to happen. He knew some of those scriptures back in Isaiah and so on. So he knew back by the time, probably at the before the flood, at Genesis, where God said that he would have to have another seed, because very likely Eve thought that Cain was that seed. So this god Attis was believed to have been conceived immaculately in the womb of a virgin, was said to have died of self-immolation at the base of a tree. You bet that was a Christmas tree too, by the way. Attis was, of course, but another version of Tammuz. Adonis, Dionysus, Orpheus, and Osiris, a god of vegetation who died and was reborn every year. See? Their god died and was reborn every year. His passion, see, the passion play, was enacted every spring in Rome, much as the passion of Osiris was enacted annually in Egypt. So you talk about the passion plays of the spring. Where do you get those terms, the passion? That was what they called that yearly, as that god was born and then, of course, died yearly. You can think that, you can see that around, a counterfeit of that today would be the old man of 1983 dies and the new baby comes in 1984. My brother and I enacted that one year. He came in as a little baby in diapers, and I came roaring in as an old man with a scythe, and we were a little dumb at that time, but we thought it was funny at that time, and so did everybody else, except I would never do it again. He didn't look like a baby, and I didn't look like very much of an old man. But notice this, though. I just thought it so much. That's why I want to read it all, just to show you what took place. Now, notice this. The festival began with a day of blood called the pagan Black Friday, commemorating the death of the young god. And after 3 days, it reached a climax in the day of joy, commemorating the god's resurrection. He died on Good Friday, or Black Friday, called Good Friday now, and was in the grave, you know, as we probably brought up Sunday morning, in favor of the sun god. So their 3 days had to be about like that. I'm pretty sure that's the way it was, although it doesn't say it here. See? So you see, that all was taking place. So they just took God's death and put it Good Friday to Sunday morning. See, all you're doing is taking Christianity and just making it fit in all those pagan days. That's all they did. But Attis was by no means the only one of the Savior gods to be imported into Rome. The Greek Dionysus, renamed Bacchus by the Latins, also had his myriads of followers, as did the Egyptian Osiris, I guess it would be. Nor was Cybele the only mother goddess, for many of the Romans preferred to worship Isis or Ma or Belana or some other of these warring fertility spirits common in all of the Orient. Indeed, it is quite impossible to give a definite account of all the mystery gods and goddesses whose cults were permitted to flourish in ancient Rome. So that's basically it. I want to read a little bit more here if I can. Talking about Augustus. When Augustus came on the scene, see, he named August after him. This is year 31 B.C. I probably ought to read it all, but I don't want to get into too much. But he was the strong, outstanding figure in Roman history because he took that corruption type of religion and put himself as the top leader of it. And he became God. That's why he is called Julius, who was the first god, July, and Augustus, the second god. See, Julius was the first god. You can find it in here. He was the first one that started the Republic in its greatness, and Augustus came along in 31 B.C. That's why they named months after themselves. But if you had followed the line of thinking, July had 31 days, and Augustus had 30. And he was not going to be outdone by Julius. And you can read this if you study the calendar. So he took another day out of poor old February and put his month as 31, you see. And that's how he did it. Smart thinking. February couldn't do anything about it. So now Augustus then, he built great temples everywhere, equipping them with beautiful idols of the old gods. So he started his temples, but he kept beautiful, you know, he made all kinds of gods and put them in the temple. He thoroughly reorganized the priesthood, making himself its head. Then he went further, a long, long way further. He realized that though there were already many gods, each with its own following in the empire, that there was no imperial god to whom all might pay homage. So to supply the need, he nominated himself by a decree of his own as emperor. He made himself the supreme deity, you see. He commanded that the guardian spirit of his own person, his genius, be worshipped in every city throughout the empire. And poets and writers were hired to invent legends telling how he, Augustus, had been originally fashioned in heaven, miraculously be brought to this world and saved it. He became a savior, you see. And as long as he lived, this religion he built around himself flourished everywhere in the empire. Everywhere save, of course, in Palestine, where dwelt the Jews. But even the revival under Augustus could not stay the debacle of old religion. On the contrary, it might perhaps have hastened it. It but opened the way for one more corroding element, a human god. Succeeding emperors emulated Augustus, deifying themselves. Sometimes they deified their wives, their mistresses, even their lewd boy companions. In time, there were almost 40 names on the roster of these monstrous gods. And meanwhile, more and more of the gods of the East came pouring into the imperial city. There seemed to be one sane element left, the cynics. Now listen to what a cynic was. The word cynic, with a small c, now connotes a disillusioned, sneering, hopeless individual. But in those days, with its initial letter was capitalized, the word connoted an altogether different sort of a man. The cynics of that time were preaching philosophers, exalted souls who felt themselves called upon to drag the people out of the sinkholes of superstition in which they had floundered. These cynics stood on the corners of the marketplace or on temple steps and harangued the people to observe the wild existences that were leading and go back to the simple natural life. They assured them that this was the only way to salvation, common sense. You see them on the streets today, you know, out there with their Bibles. You see them down on the 16th Street marketplace there on that mall area, and you'll see them out there with their Bibles. They did that back then, before the time of Christ. But despite all these devotions and eagerness, it was impossible for these things to work any profound change in their fellow man. So, it says, they went back to the old mysteries. See, they went back to the old ways again. They tried to get them out of it, but they couldn't. Now, I don't want to read all of that, but I thought it would be very good. This one brings us up to date, and I'll finish here. The root of the mystery was an ancient Persian legend. Now, this is talking about Mithraism. It entered there about the first century in Rome, and so already were the Romans to receive it that soon it was almost dominant in the empire. The root of this mystery was an ancient Persian legend which told of a divine hero named Mithras, whose miraculous birth had been witnessed only by a few shepherds who came from afar with gifts to adore this wonder child. See there? Before the time of Christ now. Mithras grew up to be the most strenuous champion of the sun god in his war against the god of darkness, and the climax of his career was a life and death struggle with a mythical sacred bull. It's bull, B-U-L-L. By finally slaying this bull and letting his blood flood the earth, Mithras gave life to the soil and earned immortality for himself. Straightway he was exalted to the abode of the immortal, and there he dwelt as the divine protector of all the faithful on earth. Long before the advent of Christianity, we find a significant religion, an elaborate ritual crystallizing around that legend of Mithras. So it's long before Christianity. To this day, there exists along the Danube and in northern Africa certain subterranean caves in which are statues and carvings depicting scenes of this tale, just like you find in all the grottos around. These caves were the secret churches of the Mithraites, and in them all manner of magic rites were once performed. Three times a day, with special elaborateness on Sunday and the 25th of December, the Mithras priests offered services in these caves. Libations were poured, bells were rung, hymns were chanted, many candles were lighted and burnt. Above all, holy sacraments were administered to the initiated. The flesh of a sacrificial animal was eaten, and its blood was drunk, and thus the celebrants were thought to take on the divinity and immortality of their blessed Lord Mithras. By a primitive process of reasoning, which we have already described in connection with Sabelli, called the Mithras, galloped to the comforting conclusion that the mere consumption of the supposed flesh and blood of the god assured them of life everlasting. So they were already taking the blood and the flesh of this Mithras. See, that's what they're taking. That's why they take it every day. When they had died on this earth, they expected to ascend into heaven through seven gates, unlocked by seven kings, which the Mithras priests possessed. And in heaven they hoped to dwell with Mithras until the final judgment day. All the unbaptized, both living and dead, were to be totally annihilated on that judgment day. Only the redeemed were to be saved. And Mithras, coming to earth a second and final time, would administer to each of them a last sacrament, and then cause them to inherit the world in peace and blessedness forevermore. Such in belief was the theology and ritual of Mithraism. It was all, in all respects, a purer mystery than those that had preceded it. It had a distinct ethical context and showed little tendency to encourage righteous and orgiastic practices. As a result, it showed promise of a persisting far longer than any other cult. Though equally fervent, it was less hysterical than its rivals. Though just as certain of its validity, it was far less given to emotional excesses. By the first century A.D., now notice this, the first century A.D., it loomed up as the foremost religion in the empire, and by the second century, it seemed destined to become the lasting religion of all the Western world, and perhaps it would have actually fulfilled that destiny had it not been for Christianity. And that's something. See, that's what, that was wrong. That's the history of Rome's religion, this believing world. Now, you can find that book usually. I've seen, I had two of those at one time, so that's not a book you can't, you don't always, you can't, you know, you can run across that pretty regular. I want to read something more about this Vesta. I thought you would like to, this is out of the Two Babylons, just to show you who this goddess was. In pagan Rome, this fire worship, this was a fire worship type of religion, a religious ceremony, and serpent worship was sometimes separate, sometimes conjoined, but both occupied a preeminent place in Roman esteem. The fire of Vesta was regarded as one of the great safeguards of the empire. It was pretended to have been brought from Troy by Aeneas, who had it confided to his care by the shade of Hector, and was kept with the most jealous care by the Vestal virgins, who for their charge of it were honored with the highest honors. The temples were where it was kept, says Augustine, was the most sacred and most reverenced of all the. And I said, if you want to read a book that probably depicts it more than any other, would be Silver Chalice. It's a good book. When I say this, all the things are probably based upon a certain amount of truth, but it's a fiction book. But it's Helena and Simon Magus going into Rome and becoming the first praetor. They went into St. Peter's, and just took over, basically. Now, I'll read that a little bit to you in just a little bit. Let's see if I can find some of this now. I'm going to spend a little bit of time reading tonight because I wanted to show you basically where these things came from. Okay, now I'll just kind of read you down here. Okay, Simon Magus, after his rejection by Peter, now this is our own literature back about 20 some years ago, so you won't be able to get it. A church of which he was head, a church designed completely to overthrow the true church of God. His idea, notice this, his idea was to blend together Babylonian teachings and some of the teachings of Christ, and especially to take the name of Christ, and thus create one universal church, but a church with Babylon as its basis. Harnack, who is a church historian, states that Simon Magus proclaimed a doctrine in which the Jewish faith was strangely and grotesquely mixed with Babylonian myths, together with some Greek additions, the mysterious worship and consequence of the widened horizon, a deepening religious feeling, finally the wild cynicism that is blending together of religious beliefs, whose chief aim was to form a universal religion, all contributed to gain adherence for Simon. Now this is volume 1, page 244. I'm trying to think of the name of the book that comes out of here. Where's that in? I can't find where that comes out of. Thought maybe I could show you. Well, actually, he doesn't have that listed down. I'll find it just a little bit later. Simon can be classified among the major group of so-called Christians, and Simon called himself such. He's called by Harnack the decidedly anti-Jewish group. So that was his whole idea. So he went to Rome to do that. When Justin Martyr wrote in 152 A.D. in his Apology, the sect of the Simonians appears to have been formidable, for he speaks four times of their founder, Simon, and we need not doubt that he identified him with the Simon of the Acts. He states that he was a Samaritan, adding that his birthplace was a village called Gitta. He describes him as a formidable magician and tells that he came to Rome in the days of Claudius Caesar, about 45 A.D., and made such an impression by his magical powers that he was honored as a god. A statue being erected to him on the Tiber between the two bridges bearing the inscription Simoni Deo Sancto, the holy god Simon. This is in the Dictionary of Christian Biography, volume 4, page 682. I don't think you'd be able to look that up, but I'll just give it to you. That these things actually happened cannot be doubted. Justin was writing to the Roman people at that time, and they could certainly have exposed Justin's credibility if what he said was not so. And that a statue of a Simon was actually erected is definite, for Justin asked the authorities in Rome to destroy it. There are many writers who live in Rome itself who afterwards repeated Justin's account. Those who wanted to reject these clear statements have nothing in their favor. Justin is clearly giving us a fact. Hastings' Dictionary of the Apostolic Church, volume 2, page 496, states that there is very slight evidence on which to reject so precise a statement as Justin makes, a statement he would scarcely have hazarded in an apology addressed to Rome, where every person had the means of ascertaining it accurately. So he says that Simon Magus went to Rome. Now, obviously, I could go through and prove that Simon Peter was never in Rome. So this is a Simon, and he is a praetor. And I know this may be a little bit long, but I want to give it to you because I think it's very important that we understand this area of it. There are many other accounts of Simon's traveling to Rome and becoming one of the great gods to the city and to the people of Rome. There are records which show that Simon prophesies that Rome will be the scene of his crowning glory when he will be adored as a god. Dictionary of Religion and Ethics, volume 11, page 522. So Simon Magus went to Rome. Now, I've already showed you last week the Samaritan religion, and I showed you the founding of it. I showed you in the time of Christ. Maybe we'll read that a little bit to kind of get our minds pretty much geared back to it. But when Simon Magus went to Rome, he found a religion already for him, you see, already in his thinking. And he was already bringing Gnosticism in, where he was going to take all of the Oriental type of religion and Platoism and the dualism, as I mentioned, and Christianity, and mold it into one. Now, I remember when I was first coming into the church, and I was studying a lot of our literature. I went in to our minister, and I sat down, and I was really confused because I wanted him to disprove everything that Mr. Armstrong had been writing. So I asked him about Christmas. I said, Christmas is a pagan holiday. And I said, it's based upon an old Roman, ceremony. And he said, yes, it is. And I said, well, what's Christmas? What's Santa Claus got to do? He agreed with everything I said. And he even told me that he didn't even believe in keeping. He said, I don't even want to keep Christmas myself. He said, he's telling me all of this. And boy, I thought, well, this is really something. I was really happy. I went home. About 2 or 3 weeks later, my brother and my sister, I think it was my brother, and then showed me a paper written up about me. And it said, we have people in our church trying to do away with some of that Christmas. And he said, we should count them as, I don't even know if you use the word heresy or heretic. I think I might still have the paper somewhere, because I kept it, because I was so infuriated. And he said, well, he admitted that all these things were, quote unquote, pagan. But he said, is it wrong to make something that is bad, turn it into something good? That's the way he ended it. Slide right to me. My wife and I went in to see another minister because my aunt was so upset. They were so upset with us that, we'll set you up with another minister. So I went in and talked with another minister. And he said, I remember he trapped himself because I knew there were Jewish feasts like Purim that the Jews had started. But he couldn't think of Purim, and he said Pentecost. Pentecost was made up by the Jews. And I went back, and I think my wife was sitting there and said, it was not back in Leviticus 23. And he turned red, and almost every time he ran out of the room, and I think he never came back. I can't remember. So my wife and I just got up and finally walked out. And then I gradually, in the beginning, of studying these things, I went maybe a little bit further than a lot of people went. Maybe some of you should have gone a little bit further, but I went in and studied them. I wanted to really know what basically was true and what wasn't. And I'd go down to the library and read a lot of the books to find out. And I remember reading one book that was a book, and I don't even know if there's ever could find it again. But it's called The Seven Madonnas of the world or something like that, of the ancient world. And I read that about all the Mary worship before the time of Christ. And so that convinced it. And back in Jeremiah 10, where it talks about the Christmas tree, of course, like I showed you the last time. And all of those worships where God was bringing Israel out of all those ways of worship. And, you know, maybe something, I think I was talking with somebody the other night, we were talking, the best way to know something is counterfeit or something is real. You know what the best way to do that? The best way you can ever tell if something is counterfeit or real is to study the real thing very closely. In other words, if you're looking for a $20 bill, this man was saying a treasury agent, he knows what a true $20 bill looks like. And he studies it so closely that when he comes across a counterfeit, he can pick it out right now. I think that's a real good. He doesn't study the false ones because, man, there'd be every kind of problems he kept looking at the wrong one. But if he studied a true one so well and studied it out, you know, microscopically, so to speak, just every little detail, and he knew the true one so well and studied it so well that when he came across the phony, he would spot it right now. And I think that's something that a lot of us need to do more. I don't know necessarily in some of these things how deep to go into some of these things. But I made this study a long time ago. You know that? And I just started studying. And I went through basically religion from that standpoint. Because I wanted to know. And that's where I come up with a lot of the things you're getting. That's why I'm keeping a tape. I want a tape tonight of this because I'm going to keep a tape of it so that when I have to go back in it again, I want to hear it. And then I can go back in, because every time you study it, you get a little bit more out of it. But this first pope was Simon the Magician. And if someday, maybe in the next few years, you better be able to understand that. Because there's a man in 2 Thessalonians that's going to stand up and do great wonders. Maybe we'll turn over there. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in there, but let's go over to 2 Thessalonians, maybe get into the Bible a little bit, just to show you what's going to take place. So that you can understand why these things are important. Notice this, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 1. Paul understood it, and in his day, what was taking place. Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter, as from us, as that day of Christ is at hand. Now notice this, verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means. For that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. That falling away has already been here. Mr. Armstrong has stated that in 1979, 1974, we had a falling away. And that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. Verse 4, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Now, I just went through that. See, the first Pontifex Maximus said he was God. That's how they were ruled, and they were Cator-type families. And then there was a chief, Pator. So we have the Padre. Padre is just a derivation of that, meaning father. And so you have, you call him the father. So, well, father, how are you today? So we call him father. He's the father over a small family. And then there's the chief one, you see. And I'll show you probably as next week goes on. I can show you how it changed and became a state religion and formed right after the Roman system and became one of its, you know, great, probably the greatest thing that ever happened to Rome to keep it where it is today is the fact of that religion. Now, notice, he opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he is God. That's what, see, what is the term? The vicar of Christ means in place of Christ. He's in place of Christ. It doesn't mean, you know, he's Christ's representative. It means that he is Christ's place. See, Simon Magus said he was greater than Christ. He thought that he was some mighty one. Remember me reading that? Where do you think they get these titles? A leopard doesn't change its spots. Simon Magus didn't think that he was a Christ follower. He said he was the Messiah. He was the great one. He was the father, the holy father of all the mysteries. He was the father of the universal church. Showing himself that he is God. Remember you not that when I was with you, I told you these things, and now you know what withholds that he might be revealed in his time. In other words, it's being withheld to be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work. It's been working for thousands of years. Only he who now restrains will let. And see, in other words, he's going to keep him restrained until he be taken out of the way. Now, I think the latest information that we got from Pasadena states that they do not believe that this pope is the final pope, because he doesn't have the proper, you know, there's just something lacking in him to be this final pope. And so they're beginning to feel more and more and more like he isn't the one. You see, God is holding it back. Like Mr. Armstrong says back in Revelation 7, he's holding back this man that's going to be revealed, who's probably going to be a very powerful being. He's going to have fire come down from heaven, it says. Because notice, as we read a little bit further, and then shall that wicked be revealed, that wicked one, whom the Lord shall consume. See, he's not going to be, you know, they throw him in the lake of fire. I think that all right there, I'll tell you when. That when they threw the beast and the false prophet in the fire, it says here he's going to be consumed. He's going to live on for eternity. That's Satan's fate. Whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusion, see, strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in righteousness. Now, I don't think we need to go down any further, but here it is. God's going to give them a strong delusion, and I think it still must be over in another place where he says he'll bring fire down from them. I'm trying to find that there. But anyhow, he's going to have all the workings of Satan with all power and all signs and lying wonders. So this powerful man's going to be after that mystery, which God calls back in Revelation 17 and Revelation 18, calls it the great whore of Babylon. Well, we'll go back there and read that. Go back again, just to kind of bring you into the realization of what we're talking about here. See? And it talks about this great system, verse 2 of Revelation 17. With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. See? Now, verse 5. And upon her forehead was the name written, Mystery Babylon, the Great. You can't put our church in that. It's Babylon's mystery that we're talking about here. The mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. You have to find it. It even says in this book here, and some of the other books, that there was two different distinct religions. There was the one in the Jew who would never accept this system, see? And then there was this system. This system was worldwide in the time of, and only the Palestinian Jews seemed to keep themselves, even though they were corrupted by it, was a different religion from the worldly religion. But then Simon Magus came out of Samaria, who had the same form, only Christianity, and he married those. He put that together. And that religion, basically, as time went on, took over and called itself the true church. And Passover was done away with. You can find that in here. Polycarp refused to go along with the ideas of this way and was killed. And almost every church leader that was of the true church of God was put to death for standing up against this type of religious heresy. It's all in your history book. And so you have a tide in there when this was kind of like Mr. Armstrong has said, there's sort of a drought of information, dark time between the time of about 70 A.D. to about 200, and about 200 A.D., a whole new church comes out of the ruins. Well, I'll show you that right here. This man mentions that in his book. If I can find it real quick. And that was really interesting what he brought out. He brings that out in here. He said a whole new religion comes out, Christianity. See if I can find it. He said, the virtues that had been formerly been ascribed to the heathen temples, to the lustrations of their statues, of their gods and heroes, were now attributed to the Christian churches. This is about 300 to 400 A.D. To water consecrated certain forms of prayer, to the image of holy men, and the same privileges that the former enjoyed under the darkness of paganism were conferred upon the latter, in other words, upon the Christian church, under the light of this gospel. Or rather, under that cloud of superstition that was obscuring its glory. It is true that as yet, images were not yet very common, nor were there any statues at all. Now, this is a historian in this book that I've got. It's called The Roman Empire. I don't know what I don't have the title of it here. I can find it real quick here, the title of it. Called the History of the Roman Empire. by Thomas Knightley. And this is what he says. All these superstitions are now to be found, in their right, and mostly mentioned in times of approbation. The Mosaic or Moses type religion, for example, had no mysteries and no mythology and worship of Hebrew. Yet the Christianity of the fourth century had them both. See? This man said, all of a sudden, he began to find that Christianity, and he began to show in this book, as you read through it, that these people who believed the way Peter and John did, in fact, one man in here said, it's amazing, they even believed in this book that God's kingdom would be set up at the end of the world. Just one man believed that. He said, no, I won't do that. I believe that the God's kingdom will be set up at the end of the world. That's in this book. So you see, these people believe. Oh, here it is. The kingdom of Christ, this guy said, in answer to his inquiries, they told him that their whole property consisted of a small piece of land which they had cultivated themselves. And they showed their hands hardened with toil. The kingdom of Christ, which they expected, they described as a celestial one, which would not appear to the end of the world. See, they knew it would not come to them. See. And he goes on to show all the way through this book how Christianity just slowly, the way the apostles were teaching it, slowly was watered down. And those people who opposed the type of religion that Simon Magus was bringing into fact and a ceremony to be used, were slowly taken over, and they were putting Polycarp and all of those ancient leaders to death. And in about 320 AD, when Constantine had conclave of all of the people coming in, they did away with the Passover, they did away with the Christian Sabbath, and made Sunday now the worship for all of the world, and they venerated Mary, and they did it right back in a place where that had been done many times before. And by about 400 AD, Christianity had totally changed from what you read in the Bible. And Mr. Armstrong states that this gospel has not been preached for 1900 years over the radio. People get upset over TV, and yet I think it's very obvious that it hasn't been preached. Who would know things like this? Only God's true church would know it. And that's why the book of Revelation probably, and I think very likely, had never been revealed to any other group of people to the end of time. Really understood what God was going to do in the end time. And like I said back in the back, they said, you're going to do a work on the face of the earth. You might turn back there too. I'm going to go through some scriptures here a little while and kind of refresh your memory in some of these things. But Habakkuk, I'll do a work in your day that even if you were told it, you won't believe it. But God, that's what he says. Habakkuk, right after the book of Micah, verse 5. Behold you among the heathen, and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your day, which you will not believe, though it be told you. And that's going to happen. People do not believe. I was thinking tonight as I was watching the news, and I was listening to all the news, I thought, and I had gone through all of this, I thought, you know, what we're going through tonight is probably the most important information that you could ever give out to this world. If all the newscasters could teach over the TV this kind of news about what false Christianity is and what it's doing to this world, and this could be on every 5:30 newscast or 5 o'clock newscast, and you could teach everybody on the face of this earth that this way is wrong and God's way is right, and they would believe it. What a fantastic thing that we would do for this world. And yet, you know, not even some of our own church people would come. Don't even come to hear it. And I think it's very important. I really do. Actually, the more I go through it, the more I think this is very, very important. Because someday you're not going to have maybe the chance to have a Bible study. Or you're not going to have the opportunity to go back and at that time establish your mind. And you should remember something like this. And you should have it studied and marked in your Bible. And don't take, you know, if you find books, go down to the library. There's a lot of good books. Some of the information I gave you are in your library. They really are. You can go down, I would say, if you live down in Denver. I tried to go down there the other day, and I realized it was $10 a day or something like that. And so I just told them to forget it. $100, so many $100 a year just to have a library card down there. And if it looks like a nice library, but Jefferson County should have one, all the other colleges, I would just suggest you get down and use your Xerox machine and Xerox the pages. That's what I do. I just Xerox them and mark them in a yellow. And I have quite a bit of the information. And I just put it together in a file, and I just keep it for another time. But it tells you where the Roman Catholicism comes from. I think the article I read about the misbelieving world almost described the church today. And that was before 600 B.C. that that religion was founded. And God's certainly making it known in this end time. When God comes back and Jesus Christ does come back, the true God, you see, all the way down through history, what Satan did, he counterfeited everything that Jesus Christ did. Even the shepherds, I was amazed at the shepherds that came and gave gifts to this being that was supposed to have been immaculately conceived. And everything that you can think of that God did, Satan has counterfeited. And what people did is they took all of the things that God did and they made counterfeits out of them. Christmas is supposed to be Christ's birth, which they celebrate every year that he's born, just like they did then. And of course, Easter is his death. And then all the way around, and they go back to that every year. Those were all forms of ceremonies years and years and years before the true Christ ever was born and the true Christ was ever killed. So it's very important. I'm going to just spend a little bit of time now in conclusion here. I want to read about a Peter that was in Rome 2,000 years B.C. I'm going to spend a little bit of time in this, and then we'll kind of conclude there tonight. And I don't know what I'm going to go through next time. I may just sum it up next time or just quit here. But pagan gods were called Peter. Surprising as it may sound, it is a well-known fact among students of ancient religion that the chief pagan gods worshipped in the early civilization were generally known by the name of Peter. It is also known that the priests of these heathen gods were also called Peter. That same name in one form or another was even applied to the pagan temples consecrated to these gods. So a pagan temple was called a Petor. Petor. Notice what Bryant, in his work, The Ancient Mythology, says. Not only the gods, but the hierophante, that means a special priest, in most temples, and those priests in particular, who were occupied in the celebration of mysteries, were called patres, P-A-T-R-E-S. This is significant that the word patre is the same as Petor or Peter in meaning and pronunciation. Bryant continues, patre was undoubtedly a religious term, the same as Petor and Petora. The ancient pagan gods, the priests who were their ministers and their sacred sanctuaries, their temples, were all called Peters. Either spelling is acceptable, either Petor or Peter, because since vowels are fluid in all languages. Now, the meaning of Peter. What did the word Petor or Peter really mean to the ancients? Surprisingly enough, the word is in the Bible. When Moses wrote about the Egyptian priests, he shows that they were called interpreters, or Peters, the interpreters of the ancient Egyptian mysteries. You can find that in Genesis 41, verse 8, where the magicians were interpreters. Like I mentioned before, that means that they could interpret ancient mysteries. It means Petor, Entor, Petor. They could enter into the mystery. Davidson shows in his Hebrew lexicon that the consonant word P-T-R, Peter, signifies to interpret, or it means interpretation. Peter itself means to an interpreter. Now, Bryant, in his book, in this one book, I won't give you all of it because they're older books, points out that the term always relates to oracle interpretation. In other words, religious type of interpretation. The pagan priests of the mystery religions were called Petors or Peters. They had the power to interpret the heathen mysteries. This is further brought out by Bunsen in his hieroglyphic book called page 545, where he shows that the Egyptians, as the Bible also indicates, called their interpreters or priests by the term of Peter. The term Peter was one of the earliest names for the pagan gods. It lasted as late as Greek and Roman times. But by that time, the term also took on a widespread secular meaning. It generally came to mean father or parent. See, the word Petor came to mean father or parent. But this was not its primary meaning at all. the word pater, when used in the religious addresses of the Greeks and Romans, meant not, as it's supposed, a father or a parent, but related to the divine influence of a deity. So it just meant a divine influence, and they just made that a father then. So pater meant originally to be a divine influence of the deity. In many ancient religions, the father was the chief priest of the family. He was called a patriarch. A patriarch. He was the chief priest of that family. That is the reason the head of the family became known as pater, or father. The father became, because of his priestly position, became known as the archpater, or as it's commonly rendered, patriarch. This is how the term pater came to signify, in a secular sense, a father, but originally it's always meant an interpreter, especially an interpreter of mystery religion. So there you find then that the term Peter came from the ancients. Now there was a time back in the time of Balaam, and you'll find out that he was from Petor, P-E-T-H-O-R. You might look that up back in Numbers, and you'll find that that's where he was from. That's the same place. He came from the city called Petor. See, it's like, you know, Vatican Hill. What's the chief building there? The Petor, the Church of Peter. Well, if you were Balaam, you came from the Petor. You came from the top temple. And that's where he was from, and it was from an area called Petor, because he was the highest ranking among those type of priests, you see. Now I could go all the way down. I want to give you something else here, though. Okay, Numbers, that would be Numbers 23. You can look this up. Numbers 23 and 22, verses 4 and 5. Numbers 23 and Numbers 22, verses 4 and 5. We read that the false prophet of Balaam was called to prophesy against Israel. We read that also this in Deuteronomy 23, verse 4. You put that down, 23, verse 4. We read that this Balaam had been called from Petor of Mesopotamia. That is, from Peter of Mesopotamia. This Petor, or Peter, either spelling is correct, was the place of an oracle temple. That was a place of a big temple. In the dictionary, proper names of the Old Testament, we find that Balaam's Petor was the sacred high place, see, called Petor. It means place of interpretation, or oracle, or temple. Here was no doubt a college of priests of whom Balaam had been appointed chief Petor. So you see all the way through your Bible. So Balaam was a chief Peter, or Petor. Now, Josephus represents this false prophet as Balaam, who lived by the Euphrates and was the greatest of the prophets of that time. Now, it says that Balaam was successor to Nimrod. You find that in Antiochus, in Epiphanes, I'm sorry, in Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 4, Chapter 6, Verse 2. It doesn't say, may not say that he's the successor of Nimrod, but he was the highest, the greatest prophet of that time. He was the Pontifex Maximus of the pagan world. His headquarters was the Peter on the Euphrates, or the St. Peter's of Mesopotamia, the chief oracle of paganism. You see? And you can go all the way down. They've even put the name of Nicholas and Balaam are the same. They have the same meaning. They point to Nimrod, the origin of, you go back into Revelation 2, and you can find that Nicholas and Balaam basically are the same titles and so on, and names. The name for Balaam is another name for Nimrod. Balaam merely represented Nimrod as his successor. So you see, Nimrod started it and came down through then Balaam. You can find some of these titles in the Old Testament. So that Petor came all the way up. So in the time of Christ then, the world, the Roman world of that time was known as the top person was Peter. I wonder if Christ didn't understand that. Pretty sure he did when he said, Simon, your name is now going to be Peter. Because God knew what he was doing all the way along. He very likely knew that is how, you know, some of these things could be brought about where people would not know. Well, listen, in conclusion tonight, I want to show you some things. I took this out of Mr. Fulton gave me his World Almanac of 1984. I want to show you the universal religion today. The population as of 1983 in the world, this is the population of the whole world, is 4,680,000,000. And 526,000. That's 4,480,526,000 people. Now, you know how many of those are Roman Catholics? Total Christian would be 1,028,170,300. That's total Christianity. And out of those, 606, almost 607 million are Catholic. And Eastern Orthodox are another 68 million. So almost 700 million people out of that are Roman Catholics. Protestants number 353, almost 354 million. Hindu people, the Hindu religion is about 457 million. So we have a grand total of all of the religions at 2,532,524,000 out of over half of the people basically are religious in one way or the other. And they're probably almost the same, except the Roman Catholicism, Christianity takes up one-fourth of all of the humans on the face of the earth would be termed Christians. And God says, you're a little flock. Fear not, little flock, for it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. That's in back in Luke 12. So almost one-fourth would be called Christian today. But before the end of time, when this tremendous power begins to come up over in Europe and probably in the next few years, and this great system begins to take over all of the world, it says all of the world does some kind of homage to her. And probably at the end of time, we're going to see a lot more of those people become Catholic. And that's what's going to be ahead of us. And it will be one whole system that's going to take over the whole world. So basically, then, that system has taken over as Christianity today. Too bad that's not the true church of the living God, that many in numbers, one-fourth of the population. Well, that's basically it. It's about 9 o'clock. I know I wanted to kind of sum it up that way. I could have spent some more time maybe in the Bible, but I just wanted to sum up how that religion, maybe I won't spend any more time in this, but if somebody wants to sometime, I'll go through some of this with it, show how that religion gradually took over, slowly, through the whole history of time, took over and became what we call today Christianity. And that's why God said, come out of her, my people, in Revelation 18. That you be not partakers of her plague. Come out of this whole world system, because God's going to pretty soon destroy it completely. So that's basically the whole rundown of the beginning of the Samaritan religion all the way down to today. And I hope it's been profitable to you. I hope it has anyhow, because I think it's a tremendously important subject. With that, then, we'll go ahead and be dismissed at 9 o'clock, and thank you all for coming.